Whether you're starting or scaling your company's security program, demonstrating top-notch security practices and establishing trust is more important than ever. Vanta automates compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more, saving you time and money while helping you build customer trust. Plus, you can streamline security reviews by automating questionnaires and demonstrating your security posture with a customer-facing trust center, all powered by Vanta AI. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. Get $1,000 off Vanta when you go to vanta.com/go. That's vanta.com/go for $1,000 off.
Two-two pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce, another Baseball America Prospect podcast. We keep rolling around. We have knocked out the entire American League. We have an AL East, AL Central, AL West, State of the Organization podcasts that are already up the Baseball America podcast feed, as well as on the Baseball America YouTube channel. Now we roll on to the National League, and we start off the National League with the National League East. We have a lot to cover today on the NL East. And by the way, if you are waiting for your team, if you're an NL Central fan of an NL Central or NL West team, we rolled out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week for the AL. We're doing the same thing this week for the NL. So, Jeff, good to see you again. And as we look at the NL East, I feel like that this has been one of the more interesting, more fascinating divisions in baseball in recent years. Yeah. And it remains that way now, even though you have kind of teams on very different trajectories, I would say, right now.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, there's been some good drafting within this division. There's been some interesting pop-up players, I think, on each of these organizations. And then you had the Marlins, who were really, really aggressive at the deadline, I think acquiring more players, or at least more prospects, than any other team. So kind of an interesting grouping here, and sort of all over the place in our system talent org rankings as well. But I think all of them have some gems and some pretty good players, and different philosophies too. So it'll be fun to dive into all that.
So to dive straight in, we're jumping in, going alphabetical order, not order of record, anything like that. That can change while we're, since from the time when we record these to the time they go live. But Atlanta Braves, the Braves have been, and I can wait to hear some Phillies and some Nats fans complain about this, but the Braves have been the class of this division for the last, you know, 5-6 years. They win the division most every year, even though there have been years where teams that haven't won the division have then gone on to the World Series, to their credit. But this has been a much rougher year, I would say, at the major league level. And a lot of that has to do with injuries, obviously. They lost Ronald Acuna for a second time to a knee injury. When you lose an MVP caliber player, that leaves a mark. Some of their long-term kind of core players haven't performed as well. Matt Olson has not performed as well as expected. They've had the injuries on the pitching staff as well. But I you know, we're trying to focus a lot of this on the farm system. And Jeff, when I look at this farm system, it's kind of the same thing that we've been saying in last several years. There are some arms here, and I can even point to a bat or two, but really it's almost designed as an uneven system. It is designed as a system that is all about developing pitchers to continue filling the rotation in the bullpen and to be traded for other pieces as needed. And position player wise, this is probably, I would argue, one of the thinnest groups in all of baseball.
Yeah. There's only three players in their top 10 prospects that are position players. There's only three players in their top 13 prospects that are position players. So, you know, I think if you're looking at pitching, you're looking at an organization that's developed some pitchers recently. I know he's hurt. He kind of falls into that bucket of Ronald Acuna and Spencer Strider, but certainly one of the better arms in baseball when he is healthy and is on the mound. They've kind of leaned into the pitching.
You mean Freed? Unless you blanked out there, I didn't hear. You're talking about Freed?
No, I was talking about Spencer Strider.
Okay, sorry, Strider.
Yeah, Strider, certainly Freed, a little bit older. You could probably give the Padres maybe a little bit of credit for that one as well, though I know he spent most of his time in the Braves organization. But just overall, they've leaned into the pitching in recent years. And I think that there's good reason for it. I think they do a good job of identifying talented arms. And unfortunately, they've, as happens with talented pitching prospects, they've had a lot of injuries. I think that's turning a little bit of a corner now. You're getting back, you know, J.R. Richie. I think, you know, Juan Carlos Lara is a really, really interesting arm in this system. Ranks 10 for us right now. I think you could even argue him up to 7 or 8 if you wanted to. It's all pretty close. They drafted Caminiti this year. You know, Hurston Waldrop last year. Went with some prep arms the previous year. You know, Phillips is no longer in the organization, but Owen Murphy is, as well as J.R. Richie. So they've leaned in early and they've kind of put their dollars toward pitching early in the draft. We'll see if it comes to fruition or not, but they do have, you know, some arm talent throughout this organization.
The other thing I would say with that, and I feel like that they're kind of similar to the Dodgers on this, I believe there's also a willingness to accept more injury risk when it comes to pitchers than maybe some other organizations do. Now, I say that like maybe I'm reverse engineering that a little bit. Spencer Strider, obviously an example of that, a pitcher who was coming off of Tommy John surgery when they drafted him and has ended up being significantly a true find. But then you look at drafts they've had after that, and we've talked about this, like, you know, you're talking about with J.R. Richie coming off of injury, but really they've had drafts where you look at almost every pitcher they have at the top of the draft ends up having some sort of arm surgery in, you know, during either before they draft him or not long after. But I think that they kind of do look at this as like, that's kind of how you acquire premium talents. And sometimes you may be even able to get a talent at a little bit, you know, at a spot in the draft that you would not be able to otherwise, because you're willing to accept that risk. And if you're trying to reduce your injury risk as an organization, volume is the way to do it. I mean, it does. If you are going this pitching heavy, and it makes perfect sense to me from an organizational standpoint, because they have a catcher locked up long-term. They have a first baseman locked up long-term, second baseman, third baseman, right fielder, center fielder, even now left fielder, if you want to say with Kelenic. When you have that, like, it makes a ton of sense that you're really just kind of looking at, okay, how do we fill out the rotation? How do we fill out the bullpen? But, you know, some of these guys, Mike Soroka was great. And then unfortunately he had what I would describe as very freak injuries that kind of derailed his career. I got to see Ian Anderson, who was very good for them a couple of years ago. Ian Anderson at AAA now looks like he might make a start, you know, probably around the time that that this goes live. But he's not better than he was then. He's probably a step behind where he was then. There is kind of the risk that goes with all of the injuries that come with pitching. But I still look at the system and say, okay, on the pitching side, when you have an A.J. Smith-Shawver and a Hurston Waldrop, Spencer Schwellenbach just graduated, but that's an absolute success story. Again, that is a credit to the Braves scouting and development, that that was a shortstop at Nebraska who pitched a little bit, who they have were willing to take the chance on making a starter, not just a pen arm, and watch him kind of blossom into a very solid member of their rotation this year. They got Richie. Owen Murphy's, you know, going to be out for a while with an arm injury of his own. A lot of arm talent here, but let's do talk a little bit about, okay, they also do have a success story, I would say, in Drake Baldwin, in that they do have a position player prospect who has exceeded expectations and now is kind of, Jeff, you know, on the door of being able to help them at the big league level.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at somebody like this and the underlying data has been there for a couple of years. He took a big step forward this year just in terms of it all kind of coming together. I think there's enough defensive ability there to, you know, project him long term as a catcher, though, you know, he's always kind of going to be a fringy defensive catcher. I think you kind of take it in a wash with, you know, how productive he is offensively. He has enough of an arm. Then it's going to really come down to how he manages the pitching staff, et cetera. There's certainly some talent there in Sean Murphy and guys that he can learn around and, you know, potentially fit in as a DH here and there when Ozuna or whoever needs a rest. So I think he's a really interesting offensive catcher. You know, how he progresses as a receiver, as a thrower at the major league level, time will tell. That's always a little bit harder, I think, just even in terms of our feedback as to what we get versus what a guy can do in an off season, just working on a couple of things, the coaching at the major league level he may or may not receive, you know, mentorship from somebody like Murphy, who's an outstanding defensive catcher. And the same thing with Travis d'Arnaud. I mean, they have two veterans there that, you know, have handled good pitching staffs, and, you know, made deeper runs in the playoffs historically. So kind of interesting to see how that all works out. But I do think that it's definitely a development win for the Braves. And he's one of the better offensive catching prospects in the minors over the last couple of years.
Yeah, he's a cusp of the top 100 type players, how I would describe him. You know, now, once you get past that, Nacho Alvarez had a very brief stint in the majors. I think that kind of cooled a little bit of Braves fans' excitement about Nacho. Now, don't take too much over a couple of games in the big leagues. But that being said, he's probably more of a useful role player than he is anything more than that. And once you get past that, Jose Perdomo, you know, Luis Gunipa, who's far away, we're kind of almost done. You know, David McCabe's coming back from Tommy John surgery. I cannot emphasize again, like when you look at this system, they're pretty low in our farm system talent rankings. We give them a little bit of credit. We try to do this. We try to evaluate when we do. We look at kind of development paths as well. Like I'll tell you right now, when we're ranking the Dodgers and we work out like here's where we think their talent is, if we're comparing them to another org, we're generally, you know, we try to do this as objective and subjective. And on the subjective side, the Dodgers have just shown year in, year out that they get more out of players. So you kind of weigh that in a little bit. When it comes to pitchers, I think you have to say that the Braves have that kind of, you know, that they have that kind of, you give them that kind of credit too, because they've done this time and time again with pitchers. But at the same time, this is not a system. When the trade deadline rolled around, the thing that stood out to me is none of the massive names were traded. We didn't see a Tarek Skubal. We didn't see a Garrett Crochet traded. I don't know if they had been, if the Braves really could have competed as far as the offers that were out there. They probably could have figured out a way if they were willing to trade a massive amount of their pitching depth away. But at the same time, Jeff, and I look at it, I don't think, you know, I just don't feel like that this is an organization right now that has the prospect depth. Trade deadlines passed now. They can make moves around the edges like they did, but I don't think they were really as well positioned to make a massive move if they needed to.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's sort of what ready-made position players can afford you. You know, we saw some of the bigger prospects that were moved at the deadline, you know, whether that's Kikuchi, who's been really good for the Astros. They had to move a couple of, you know, ready-made players, one in particular who was a position player that more or less slotted right into the Blue Jays' everyday lineup. And, you know, I think it's sort of the same with the Miami Baltimore trade, you know, in terms of what they sent with Connor Norby and Kyle Stowers. I just think that when you have positional depth and then you're trading away for pitching, it typically works. It's more attractive. And I think there's probably less that can go wrong. And we don't really see big name pitching prospects that are performing. They kind of rarely get traded too.
No, that's kind of true. So that's the Braves. And now I think not the most interesting big league club, but I think this is going to be one of the most interesting teams we talk about on the state of the organization situation is looking at the Miami Marlins and what is really a very reworked Marlins farm system. Obviously, Peter Bendix came in. At the big league level this year has been a very much a step back. I don't think there's any other way to say that. But then when you look at the rebuilding they've done at the trade deadline, how excited should Marlins fans be about this farm system now, Jeff?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing with this system too is even outside of the top 10 or some of the bigger names that they've acquired, you start to look at the back end of this system and there's some interesting players. Javier Sanoja has been really interesting this year. Elizer Dishmay is a really interesting pitching prospect in the lower minors that has pretty good stuff. And then you look at the top and you have Thomas White and then, you know, the pair of Myers here and Max and Noble. But even throughout this top 10, I think just because of what they've done at the trade deadline and even earlier in the year, they've been able to add some talented position prospects, whether that's Augustin Ramirez, who's, you know, big power and some pretty good contact. And hopefully, you know, he's been in a little bit of a slump the last month or two, but gets back to where he was earlier in the year. And I think still has plenty of time to do that and sort of round a corner. And a big power prospect on top of that, Connor Norby, who we've talked about, kind of a ready-made guy. Dylan Head, who they acquired in the Luis Arraez trade. A couple of different pitchers here, one who's ready-made in Adam Mazur, another guy in Robbie Snelling that, you know, I think was our minor league pitcher of the year last year. Certainly he's not completely done, though his stock has dropped quite a bit this year. Davison De Los Santos, one of the bigger power prospects in the game. So they have a lot of these, a cusp of the top 100 types, and then sort of a nice group of talented pitchers up at the top of the system, two younger arms in White and Noble Meyer, and then a guy who's in their rotation right now and probably will graduate before the off season comes in Max Meyer. So I think it's a really interesting system. Is it among the elite systems in the game? No, I think it's more of a mid-tier talent system, but you can't argue with the depth and some of the talent that they brought into this organization over the last 18 months or so.
So here's the opportunity and the danger as I see it on the position player side, right? We've seen Xavier Edwards, I would describe as a little bit of a reclamation project. I think they got him at a relatively modest cost from the Rays, because I feel like that the Rays were kind of looking at it from a 40-man roster, from a where does he fit on the infield depth chart, and was like, okay, we're willing to trade away Xavier Edwards, who they themselves had acquired, I believe, from the Padres a couple of years before that. But you look at what Xavier Edwards has done so far, and you go, okay, great. Maybe that's a guy you can help build around. At the big league club, before the trade deadline, I would say that, I guess I'll throw it to you, especially after they traded Arraez away. Was there anyone else on this big league club? Chisholm and Arraez have been traded away. Brian De La Cruz traded away. Josh Bell's gone. You know, not really traded away in that case. But was there anyone else position player-wise that you look at on this big league club and say, okay, that's a guy that you want to hold on to because he could not be, even if it's a star, but be a regular on a successful team? I might throw Jesus Sanchez out there. That'd probably be I don't know if I can go there with Jake Berger.
Yeah, I was going to say it would probably be Berger or Sanchez. Sanchez, a little bit younger, can do a few more things. Berger, though, is, you know, had really good years. If that's, you know, sort of your DH corner infield coverage type, if you have five or six hitters around him and that's your six hitter with some pop that, you know, can hit 30 home runs, I think that can work in a good team. He's also 28, you know. I don't know how long of a shelf life, you know, he necessarily has. They're going to have to build a lot more for him to be part of any really competitive organizations, whether that's signing guys from outside the organization or developing the guys that are within the organization, some of these players that they've traded for. But I don't see any, there's no standout stars here. This is a team where, you know, somebody's going to make an all-star team simply because they're the best player on the Marlins. It's one of those sort of situations versus somebody who's really going to get votes and be a legitimate all-star.
So here's my concern with the players they've acquired. I can map out a best case scenario where they acquired almost a team of 2025, mid 2025, late 2025 regulars, right? You could add Davison De Los Santos at first base. You could put Augustin Ramirez behind the plate. You can put Connor Norby at second base. You can figure out a way to get there. Graham Pauly at third. You know, you can get there. Every one of these guys, though, I would say fits in that category of, in an ideal scenario, they're a 55 at a big league level, right? They're an above average regular. That's a rosy scenario. There are possibilities for all of these to be 50s, which if they are, that would be, I think, absolutely success. If you just said that these are your standard run-of-the-mill big league regulars. If Connor Norby is a guy who gives you a fringy defense at second base, but hits enough to be a three war player, 2.5 to 3 war player every year. You'd go thumbs up. We're good with that. You know, if Pauly gives you enough defense and hits enough to be basically a new version of what Brian Anderson was for them early in his career, you say, okay, we can live with that. But I feel like that everyone they've acquired, which is understandable considering what they were trading in return, but everyone that they've acquired on the position player side is kind of on that yeah, but level, if that makes sense. Does that make, you know, am I making any semblance of sense there, Jeff, from the standpoint of like, Augustin Ramirez could be really good, but there's he's at a kind of fork in the road where if his defense is enough to be a catcher, a regular catcher, then great. If it's not, his bat might be enough, but it also could not be enough. Like, they didn't, understandably considering where they're traded, but there's not really a whole lot of just plug that guy in and don't worry about it. You're just good to go. These are more position players where everyone's going to get an opportunity and we'll find out, we'll sort out which ones of these actually are going to be able to take advantage of that opportunity, as I see.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the lingering question with this whole group. There's some guys who could turn into be pretty solid regulars, you know, particularly Augustin Ramirez or Connor Norby, or even Davison De Los Santos. But it's a matter of like them overcoming some of the warts in their game. It's, you know, approach to a degree, but certainly the defensive side of things with Ramirez. I think there's some questions about the bat path and just how well he elevates in his hard contact. Norby, I have a little bit less questions about, but I just don't think the upside is necessarily significant. And De Los Santos is obviously, you know, contact is a huge issue at this point.
The way I can put it is the best way I can describe this is if you look at some of the players who now are moving on, they kind of were the earlier versions of this. And again, I get this. You cycle through. This is something where Peter Bendix came from the Rays. This is what the Rays do as much as anybody. But Jake Berger was acquired in part because he was a player who had flaws. And he's been pretty good for them. He also is a guy who in a normal year is going to give you a 290 to 305, 310 on base percentage. You know, a limited and not much defense. So a limited player. Brian De La Cruz, they just moved on. The Astros were willing to include him in a deadline deal because they viewed him as more of a fourth outfielder than a regular. And that's kind of been, again, he's on the cusp of, you can say he's a second division regular probably, but it'd be hard to say that Brian De La Cruz has been more than that since they acquired him. Yeah. Vidal Brujan, who was gotten a lot of plate appearances for them this year, probably more of a utility guy. We've seen this. They've done this in the past. You know, and now they're on to the next version of it. But I do think if you're looking big picture, they're going to have to draft and develop better than they have in recent years to kind of break this cycle. I guess it would be the other way I would put it, Jeff. Is this like, now JJ Bleday's ended up being fine, but he's fine elsewhere now. You know, they've done this well on the other side where they did, you know, acquire. Okay, so the A's have them on JJ Bleday. But the Marlins have the A's on it, you know, on some other moves, AJ Puck, you know, Jesus Luzardo. There's a little bit of both going on here. But where do you think, like on the draft and development side, they've gone a little pitching heavy lately, but where do you think they are there? I guess would be the last question on the Marlins.
Yeah, I think in terms of drafting and identifying arms, they've done a good job. I think that's kind of rolled through this organization, regardless of who's in charge at the top over the last 7 or 8 years. They've
continued. There's been a lot of different people in charge.
Yeah, I mean, there's been about three, so or four even. But I think you sort of look at it, and whatever coaches they have in the organization, whatever they're doing, it works because they've gotten a lot of different arms and pitchers just generally up to the major leagues. They've seen success with some of the higher rated guys, other guys that I think just as a prospect, maybe Braxton Garrett wasn't ranked all that high. They've gotten some pretty good production out of him when he's been healthy. Just overall, they seem to sort of churn out pitchers. They've had a lot of injuries, but and they've come from different backgrounds. There's been high school guys, there's been college guys, players that they acquired from other organizations that have gotten better, and international signings too. Don't forget Yuri Perez is, you know, just passed his rookie eligibility, but was a prospect, you know, a little bit over a year ago. and has just unfortunately dealt with an arm injury, which is something that is just consistent with all pitching prospects. When we talk about pitching prospects across all these different organizations, that seems to be the common thread. So yeah, I think overall it hasn't slowed down, because we've seen a much better version of Thomas White than the guy that was pitching here in Massachusetts a little bit over a year ago. Noble Meyer is a good prospect, both top 100 guys. Max Meyer dealt with some injuries, but you know, hasn't necessarily slowed down. He's still a top 100 prospect and somebody with pretty good pedigree that's obviously in the major leagues now, though the results have been somewhat inconsistent. So I think overall they've done a good job. And you kind of look at some of these arms like Mazur and Snelling coming from what historically has been a worse development program in San Diego. And, you know, potentially those guys can turn a corner over the next year or so. I'm interested to see how Snelling progresses under, you know, the eye of the Marlins pitching development, and kind of the same thing with Adam Mazur.
I see. Okay. Now I'm going to push back and point out the other version of it though, which is that when it comes to position players, especially first round position players, you have to go back really to Christian Yelich to have the last Marlins first rounder who was good for the Marlins, right? They drafted Josh Naylor in the first round, but then they moved him pretty quickly thereafter in the Andrew Cashner deal, if I remember correctly. They had Colin Moran, who did reach the big leagues and was a regular at least briefly, but they kind of soured on him very quickly and traded him away. Since then, it was Connor Scott who never – the Kyle Tucker comparisons he had coming out of high school soon faded away. J.J. Blade, who we noted, struggled for them and then was traded. Khalil Watson, very quickly traded for them. Jacob Berry, who is still in the organization but has not lived up in any way to what you would expect for a college bat who was taken sixth overall. That PJ Morlando, you know, the hope is that this will be the first position player taken by the Marlins to actually have success for the Marlins in over a decade. But that's where they've got to do better, in my opinion, is that they've, when they have taken position players high, they've really, those players have not hit the ground running in pro ball. And even when they have had success, it's been after they get traded somewhere else to develop, in a case of a Naylor or someone like that. So that's what will be interesting to see what happens with, again, a new regime here with the Marlins. The thing that is, as you noted, kind of there, that is looking up for next year is they, this year was always going to be a little bit of a lost year when your best pitcher, Sandy Alcantara, is out and should be back next year. You know, Yuri Perez should be back at some point. Max Meyer should be a year further away for Tommy John surgery. Their rotation could get pretty interesting before too long. But there's still obviously a lot here to do.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform of over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes, it does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. The heat of summer is here. Whether you're going for a long run or just sitting by the pool, your favorite summer treat could be giving you extraordinary hydration. Liquid IV has refreshing summer flavors like Popsicle Firecracker and Rainbow Sherbet that hit the spot when you need transformative hydrating relief all summer long. Indulge in hydration with electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients from the number one powdered hydration brand in America, Liquid IV. Did you know that blue and pink cotton candy are different flavors? I didn't until I started enjoying both of them through Liquid IV. Personally, I'm partial to the blue cotton candy. I make sure I pour some in my water bottle with some ice before I head out on a bike ride. It not only hydrates, but it's a more enjoyable way to stay hydrated. Blue cotton candy. That's my recommendation. But I've yet to find a Liquid IV flavor I don't like. Cool off your summer with the reimagined flavors of treats like Rainbow Sherbet and Popsicle Firecracker. Or make your own Liquid IV popsicles. Indulgent flavors keep your wellness rituals fresh and keep you motivated and hydrated. Find all your favorite flavors on the website. There's acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. You can even choose from their line of sugar-free flavors like raspberry melon, white peach, and green grape. The white peach, that's pretty good too. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's powdered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. Three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, eight essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Indulge in hydration this summer with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
Now, that's kind of the flip side when we get to the Mets. When we talk about the Mets, they've had a really good year in the farm, on the farm system, on the pitching side. And a year where I feel like their best position player prospects, almost without fail, what you say is to be determined, because they've almost all been hurt, as I see it, Jeff. Like, but I do still feel like this is not a bad year on the farm for the Mets because of how many of their pitching prospects I feel like have taken a step forward.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting system, and one where I think you can start to see, you know, how some of their hires have impacted some of the development within the organization. They've done a good job of, I think, identifying pitchers that maybe don't have traditional backgrounds. Christian Scott was primarily a reliever at Florida. Brandon Sproat, they tried to sign twice and landed him. Nolan McLean's a guy that was initially drafted by the Orioles, went back to school, and then comes back out after another season at Oklahoma State, where he really concentrated more on the pitching side of things. And he's developed into a really interesting pitcher. I'd say even beyond that, they have some higher upside position players. This is the first system that we've talked about today that has three or four guys who could project as everyday regulars or potentially better. When you look at Jett Williams, Drew Gilbert, Mauricio, Ryan Clifford, Carson Benj is a really interesting player. And then they have some international players sprinkled throughout who I think are pretty good. This is a fairly deep system.
It is a deep system. I would say, and this is the deep system where, when I talk about the injuries, Jett Williams was having a very good season, and then he's missing half the year with a wrist injury, if I remember correctly. You know, Ronnie Mauricio's season never got started because he had a significant knee injury. Drew Gilbert's missed it a lot of time. On the position player side, they have guys who you're like, okay, they're very promising. The unfortunate thing is they're not going to be that much further, that much closer to the big leagues next year than they should have been because they're coming back from injury. But then when you see what Christian Scott did in the big leagues before he went on the IL, when you see where Sproat, Tidwell, McLean are now, I do feel like I feel like that where the Mets are right now is they've got to figure out, okay, this is not a team that's going to next year, I feel like, be comfortable saying, hey, we're going to give these guys 250, 300 play appearances to figure out what they are. We're going to turn over two spots in the rotation to figure out which of Scott, Sproat, Tidwell are ready to fit in our rotation. I think it's going to be much more of like, they've got to have some of these guys step up, but knowing that there's also going to be probably further moves to add in veterans, to bring in free agent talent and all, because my sense is that this is not a team that's going to be willing to kind of say, okay, 25 is just another year along the path.
Yeah. I think that's a possibility. I also think that if some big name players come available on the trade market this offseason, I think some of these players could end up in another organization come spring training. you know, we know that ownership and Cohen are not scared to spend money and wouldn't be scared to take on big contracts. So I think if they can land that big fish, it wouldn't shock me if some of these players do get moved for reinforcements in the major league level, because this is a team that is pretty competitive this year. They're in the mix, certainly, for the playoffs. You know, whether they take that next step, we'll see. I don't think the expectations were terribly high for this team. But next year, coming off a season like this, having a deeper farm system, I think there's a handful of these players that could end up as part of a package for a bigger deal if it's out there. You know, maybe it's Crochet, maybe it's somebody like that. We don't know who's going to be available in the open market, you know, come December and January. But I get the feeling, you know, down in my gut feeling on this one is that there could potentially be some trades for the Mets.
And I don't want to even also ignore that there are some guys who no longer are prospect eligible could fit into that too, right? Like, we have seen reports that there were teams interested in Brett Beatty at the deadline, which makes a whole lot of sense. He's still only 20, you know, I think he'll be 25 next year. So you are talking about a guy who, while he hasn't established himself at the big league level, I think still does carry value to other teams who are like, okay, hey, we're comfortable giving him 250 plate appearances and figuring out where he is. Mark Vientos kind of has done a good job this year with that, where he's kind of taken charge of that. But again, if you told me that they have young big leaguers who are cost controlled, who are still inexpensive, who could also be parts of some of these moves, especially if we're talking about, like, I kind of can imagine Tigers fans screaming at me when I say this, but like, if you're the Tigers, and let's say that Skubal becomes available in the offseason, you're not going to trade Tarik Skubal for guys who are all 4 or 5 years away, because that's not where the Tigers are in their cycle, right? The only reason to trade him, you know, Garrett Crochet, it could be for the highest ceiling guys who are years away, or it could be guys who could help now, because the White Sox, I don't know when their window opens, but the Tigers window should be open pretty soon. And so they're going to be looking more, and that's where the Mets would fit pretty nicely here, because when we talk about the pitchers we talked about, and the Jet Williams and the Mauricios and all these guys, the Brett Beatty's, they're all not that far away. These are guys who are in the upper levels of the minors, whether they're coming back from injury or not, where if you acquire them in a deal, you're not saying, okay, well, this is a wait till check back on us in 2027. I kind of follow what you're saying. Like, I do feel like this is an organization pretty well primed on that, because the other part of this is, I know Alonso's, you know, nearing free agency, you know, things like that, but you look at the big league core here, there are a lot of guys on this team who've had very solid seasons this year, especially on the offensive side. This team's a little bit better maybe than we thought coming into the year, I'd say, as far as the pieces they have, where I don't see there's going to be the openings for bringing up 3, 4, 5 rookies or anything like that. Maybe make more sense for them to be looking this offseason for a couple moves like that, just considering how many of their better prospects are in Double A or higher?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, reasonable to expect, especially, like I said, what the expectations are there. So I think it's something that could certainly be on the docket for, you know, how the offseason is handled. It's a good spot to be in, because I do think that they have a lot of different directions they can go here, and enough to keep some of these players and still trade some others away for reinforcements when needed.
So, okay, so that's the Mets. Now we go to the Phillies, who we've kind of highlighted as one of the organizations that, you know, has kind of taken a step forward here. They were pretty aggressive at the deadline, I would say, in kind of helping themselves in a little bit of a variety of ways. They made moves, both trading off of the big league club, you know, and kind of moving some guys, especially out of the bullpen. Sir Anthony Dominguez, Gregory Soto, who's kind of struggled a little bit, I think, in his first week or so with the Orioles. But they also made moves to help the big league club, trading, you know, George, trading with the Angels and bringing, you know, Carlos Estevez to the Phillies, trading away George Klassen and Samuel Allegheny. And the thing that stands out about it is, I like how the Phillies are doing this, in my opinion, because to take an example, like, Klassen is an example of trading a player who you made better. He is a developmental success story, that then allows you to use him as a significant piece to add a significant and very useful piece to your bullpen, player to your bullpen, where coming into the year, I don't think George Klassen could be kind of the anchor of a trade like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen what the Phillies pitching development can do, you know, in that regard, in terms of taking guys that have major question marks, particularly around command, but big stuff, and getting them to a point where, you know, they're sort of an interesting trade piece. And, you know, I like Klassen better. I think he projects better than Griffin, than Griff McGarry ever did. But I think you sort of look at what they did here of trading Klassen before, you know, sort of the bottom fell out, which is something they didn't do with Griff McGarry when he, you know, he probably had some trade value, you know, back in 2022, particularly toward the end of the season. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly something that you can give them credit for. Have they been able to get a lot of these guys up to the major league level and turn them into successful starters? I think that's another question entirely. That might change with Andrew Painter once he's back and healthy. Certainly his abilities are far beyond some of the other names that I just mentioned. But yeah, I think, you know, credit to them for getting Klassen to a point where he can sort, and the same with Al Dejiri, you know, two guys coming into the year that I don't think were terribly highly touted and were really good performers that have some traits and attributes that I'm sure teams really like.
Okay. So I'm going to kick this back right back to you with, now let's talk about Justin Crawford, who is a guy who there are, you know, he's not a five tool, all, you know, everything's well-rounded and exactly as you want to draw up with a prospect. He hits the ball on the ground more than an ideal, you know, doesn't really get to his strength as much as there is some strength there. But at the same time, if you focus on that too much, you might kind of ignore the fact that this is also a 2022 draftee who's a 312 career minor league hitter, you know, good on base, steals bases, runs are, you know, athletic in the outfield, and probably is eventually going to get to more power. He's still quite young. How excited, if you're a Phillies fan, is this a be very tempered in your enthusiasm, or is this more of a, wow, this is a guy who really could be kind of a next cornerstone type player?
I think it's more the former than the latter there. You really need to see them sort of make some adjustments to a swing just to get, because there is raw power in the package. He hits the ball fairly hard. It's just everything is top spin. Everything is top spin. And I think that's kind of a consistency with, you know, all of their top hitting prospects here. I think you can probably make a similar case with Aiden Miller, Starlin Cabas, you know, fairly ground ball heavy. Caba and Crawford are similar in that they have, we'll say, plus or better defensive value long-term, where I think Crawford can be, you know, outstanding in center field. He's shown the ability to hit. The contact, the bat to ball skills are absolutely there. You know, how much of that can you sort of sacrifice in order to get him to lift the ball a little bit more consistently? If he's a 10 to 12, even 15 homer guy, that's a cornerstone player potentially. It's an up the middle, you know, outfielder that can play, you know, a standout center field, steal bases once he's on and wreak havoc, take the extra base, score a lot of runs, be sort of a table setter at the top of the lineup because of what his skills are. It's just a matter of getting that, coaxing a little bit more impact out of him. And I think the impact is there. It's just a matter of getting it, you know, elevated so we can actually do some damage consistently, which is just something that he hasn't done at all as a professional.
I have to bring up the comparison because we're not big on comps normally, but I will add, you know, like when we look at Carl Crawford, I will note that when Carl Crawford was coming up through the Rays organization, 18, 19, 20 years old, 6 homers, 4 homers, 7 homers, you know, so. And by the way, not all, you know, he had more doubles than Justin does. But if you said, like, is he tracking kind of along that same line? I would say, yeah, he kind of is hitting for average, getting on base, and saying when he's still a teenager, when he's still a 20-year-old, okay, there's still some power development to come here. I will note that with his, you know, with Carl Crawford, that ended up not really arriving, I would say. And again, Carl Crawford was never a 25, 30 home run guy, but you are talking about someone who was hitting 300, you know, with leading the league in triples year after year after year. I don't think it's crazy to think that this is at least within the realm of possibility with Justin Crawford. And again, that would be, as you said, he could, if he can just get 10 to 15 homers, play defense, hit for average, that's going to be a really a foundational type piece. And I don't think that that's absurd to think that that's within the realm of possibility here. That, but you also mentioned like Aiden Miller kind of had an incredible first half of the season, kind of tailed off a little bit after he got promoted. But where's your kind of, I know you spent a lot of time kind of looking and paying attention to Miller. What do you see as kind of his to-do list as we kind of go forward into 2025?
I think it's just finding more consistency in terms of, you know, what his bat angle is at the point of contact. He is a guy that does top spin the ball quite a bit on his hardest hit drives, you know, lifting the ball a little bit more to his pull side, which is, I know, something that he talked about when he was at the prospect pad that he's working on. They've calmed down the hitch that he had in his hands a little bit from
significantly.
From his time as a prep, it's still kind of there, but it's just way toned down. So he is hitting the ball to his pull side a little bit more. Everything was really like middle oppo contact when I saw him fresh out of the draft in the complex last year. That definitely has gotten better. I think the defense has gotten better. He's not a shortstop long term, though. I know there's some fans in the game, in terms of evaluators and decision makers, that feel a little bit differently about that. But I think long term, probably the best fit for third base. He has a decent arm, moves well enough over there. And then it's a question of, you know, can he get to that power? Because he's another one that will show, you know, consistently good exit velocities. He hits the ball pretty hard. I think there's some projection there if he's able to lift the ball a little bit more to his pull side and, you know, get into some of that air pull percentage, which is such a hot metric within front offices right now in evaluating players. But I think universally, when you speak to evaluators throughout the game, they have a pretty high grade. You'll get a lot of 60s. On Aiden Miller. I'm a little bit more skeptical just because of what the upside is with the defense and the athlete and, you know, him actually getting, you know, making another adjustment to his swing and hopefully not crashing out some of that contact and approach that he has. But certainly the ingredients are there for, you know, an average or an above average regular, I think, pretty easily. And then we'll see what the ceiling is.
So that takes us to our final NL East team. Look at the Nationals. And it's been a definite step forward at the big league level. This is, if you're a Nationals fan, this is the first year that you have seen really kind of the rays of actual hope, seeing what CJ Abrams has done, getting James Wood to the big league, seeing some kind of, I would even say, surprising performances. DJ Hertz is not, you know, going out and shoving every start, but he's had two starts already at the big league level that, I will just be honest, are far beyond anything that I ever imagined he would do at the big league level. He's had two just utterly incredible starts at the big league level. But you look at this farm system, Wood's going to graduate soon. The Nationals are ranked very high in our organizational talent rankings, and we call those snapshots. And I will say, it is a snapshot. James Wood qualifying, the difference, if we'd have said we're going to roll this out 2 weeks from now, the Nationals would have fallen several spots. That's where the org talent rankings are useful, but also have their limitations. He's still a National. He's still in the organization, still under team control for the next 6+ years. It just means he wouldn't be eligible for our farm system rankings anymore. But that leads us to their number two prospect right now, who soon will be their number one prospect, Dylan Cruz. And where you stand, Jeff, like I kind of feel like right now, and if you see where Dylan Cruz is ranked for us, you may think, okay, this is the next utterly premium big leaguer, like fixture. And I think of him kind of right now, I have a little bit of skepticism much more so than I have skepticism about him being a solid big leaguer. I guess my question is that I'll pose to you is do you see him as he just needs to do this and this to be that kind of running mate with, you know, Abrams and Wood as far as kind of future all-stars, you know, perennial all-star types, or is it more of he could be a useful complementary piece, you know, to that group?
Yeah, I think that there's been some work on his swing and just approach from the guy that we saw at LSU. He's pulling the ball a lot more in AAA. I think that's intentional. And getting to his best contact, to his pull side, like we just talked about with Aiden Miller, isn't always necessarily the easiest fix. It does take some time to get there. He's been a more aggressive hitter as a professional. He's swinging more. He's walking a lot less. I think that's the biggest shock, is this is a guy that we sort of anticipated would walk 12%, 13% of the time throughout his tenure in the minor leagues. He's never had a walk rate above 9.4% at any given stop. The contact has been really good. He's not striking out almost at all in AAA over 36 games. Now he's got a 16.8% K rate. There is some really power there. Yeah, and I think we'd like to see a little bit more power. But I think that maybe the stats aren't as loud as people would hope just from a performance standpoint. But I think there's some good things when you look under the hood here and you can say, all right, like there's a hit tool here. We know that he can run. He's learning to pull the ball a little bit more. The exit velocity data has always been really good with him. And they're actually trying to make some adjustments to sort of get the best out of Dylan Cruz. So it will be interesting to see what type of player he is in 2 to 3 years. I'm not completely out on it. I do think that there it's reasonable at this point to have some skepticism just around a guy who was, you know, a historic college player that hasn't ever really hit the ground running and at any given stop dominated. Really the closest that we saw was him in, you know, low A for 14 games out of the draft last year. You know, other than that, he was pretty good in double A, but once again, it wasn't outstanding. He's never slugged, you know, 500 for, you know, any substantial amount of time. And I think that's something that surprises me a little bit. He's walking a little bit less, but there are a lot of ingredients here, once again, for this guy to turn into an above average regular. I don't know if the superstar upside is still as prevalent as we thought, but I think things could change pretty quickly in a year if he does figure out a couple of things and just gets to a little bit more of that power and maybe even walks a little bit more as well. So it'll be interesting to see how it progresses. I know that he was a guy that got, I think, one best defensive outfielder in the International League. So there are some fans for sure in terms of, you know, what he can provide on the field. And he is a well-rounded player. So it's not altogether gone, but there's definitely a little bit less excitement around Dylan Cruz versus where we were a year ago, where we thought this guy was, you know, on par with Wyatt Langford or even some of the guys that have come out of the draft this year, and, you know, Charlie Condon or Travis Bazzana or Christian Moore, who have all seemed to perform pretty well.
We're basically now one full minor league season in for, I mean, really pretty almost dead on that, considering when he made his debut last year. And it's 122 games. It's 274, 349, 450. Most of that time obviously being spent at double A and then some at triple A. Little bit of complex league and, a, you know, 14 games of low A in there as well. But kind of that fits with what we're talking about, what Jeff's talking about here, which is it's like, okay, there's some good here, but, you know, it's 14 homers, it's 25 steals over the course of the season. It's yet to be this loud. There, you would expect that there was some point, what you're kind of hoping to see is that month where he's 300, 400, 500, right? Where it's like, okay, hey, Harrisburg or Rochester has been just carried on their back by Dylan Cruz because that's what Dylan Cruz can do. We just haven't seen that yet. Doesn't mean it's not in there, but it does mean that also, though, does mean that there's, if you said, okay, coming out of the draft, if you thought, I would say that if you thought that his possible outcomes were, you know, a 10% shot that he's a 7 at the big league level and a 25% shot that he's a, you know, 6 and then a 45% shot that he's a 5, I would say that you probably have that 7 and 6, those percentages have probably moved down, even though I would still maybe even bump up the chance that he's going to be a 5, that he's going to be a solid big league regular. Those have gone up because he has not fallen on his face. There's no Jacob Berry here where you're like, oh, you know, what happened? The hitting ability seems to have taken a big step back. There's nothing like that here, but we are talking about a situation where he just really hasn't really had a stretch yet where you're like, wow, look at what Dylan Cruz is doing now. Who beyond Cruz, I think we have to bring up two pitchers to talk about that are kind of the flip side of, ooh, this is really encouraging. Harlan Susanna, who was a player that they acquired a couple of years ago, has kind of been a guy with this incredible arm that there's been this wait for, like, okay, when are the results going to match the stuff. I feel like the results are starting to match the stuff, Jeff.
Yeah, the command has taken a big step forward, particularly since he made the jump finally to high A. He has spent parts of the last three seasons, with their low A affiliate. The command seems to have gotten much better in high A over his first three starts. It's the lowest walk rates we've seen. I think the biggest thing is he's consistently been missing bats and striking out batters all throughout 2024. And when you talk about someone with huge stuff and potential like Susanna, that's good to see. You know, you could still fall back on that, even if the command is still kind of fringy. But overall, I think, you know, the strike throwing has been better. I think, you know, the swing and miss has been better. Just the general execution overall has been a lot better. So that's certainly something that I think is worthwhile and good to see. And he was a name that I would have brought up as well.
And the other one that I will also throw in there that, okay, we're going to admit we're probably, if we do another adjustment before the end of the season, we're a little light on, you know, we're trying to hit this as a moving target, and every now and then we'll miss on one and we'll admit it. But Travis Sikora has had an especially, like, the light bulb has gone on for him very early in his pro career. I don't want to make it sound like he'd been wandering in the wilderness for years. But, like, if you look at the improvement that he's made over the course of the season, he's really been lights out in the second half of the season so far.
Yeah, he's throwing strikes. He's missing bats. He's got good stuff. You know, he's a big guy, 6'6". You can, you know, 230 pounds. You can project that as a starter and a guy that can handle innings.
Who's 6'95", too. I mean, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Made 14 starts this year and has been, you know, really good. Keeps the ball in the ballpark as well, despite being sort of a fly ball guy, which I think is encouraging to see. And, you know, with somebody like this, you know, it's always about the polish and just how well they actually execute from day to day as a starter. He's done that primarily and done it pretty well, and he's got the stuff to match. So I think Sikora is definitely an arm in the system that you could maybe slide up pretty much into the top 10. I don't think that's saying anything too crazy. And even another guy in Andre Lara has been better this year. Just showing up, you know, I was doing, did an article, of Thursday of last week that got released, that I looked at, you know, some of the top performing pitches, and Lara had actually showed up close to the top five in some of the swing and strike rate numbers. So, you know, he's missing some bats, though it hasn't been outstanding. He's missing bats. He's executing. He's getting deeper into starts. I think there's some things to definitely like about him. Though, you know, since he went up to Double A, those 13 starts, the swing and miss hasn't been there like it was in Wilmington. I think you still look at him and you say, hey, this is a younger pitcher, you know, that's whatever, just turned 21 at the beginning of the year, I'll be 22 going into next year. Bigger guy, big stuff, you know, did have some pedigree as an amateur. And you could say, hey, they've done a good job with this guy as well. So credit to the Nationals. It looks like the development has been turning a corner over the last year.
The last thing I want to end with is also on them is when you look at what they did at the trade deadline, I just like that they added further depth. They added more kind of paths to big leaguers, right? Like Alexander Clemmy is obviously kind of the high upside acquisition. But when you talk about Clemmy, Caden Wallace, Jose Tena, Rafael Ramirez, like Tyler Stewart, not all of those guys are going to click. I can promise you that not all of them are. But that being said, they didn't give up a ton. They gave up nothing that I would say is like, wow, okay, they really took another step back at the big league level. That was a great haul for Lane Thomas. Lane Thomas fit what the Guardians needed, but I love the return that they got for him. I look at where this organization is right now, and it does feel like it's definitely trending back in a better direction. Like we had a couple of years ago, they were really, I mean, the thing that was happening is they were drafting guys who they were drafting high risk guys who the risk seemed to often overcome the upside. You know, Elijah Green, the strikeouts have, he's still one of the toolsiest players in the minors, but he's got to make more contact for that to work, things like that. But you look at, there's two big things I think that have happened. One, if you trade a guy like Juan Soto, you're always going to be at a disadvantage because you're trading one of the best players in baseball. But when you do that, you got to hit on the return. And if you hit on the return, you can really start a rebuild. And if you miss on the return, you could really derail your team for multiple years. And I think at this point, If you look at that move, if you look at the Trey Turner move, they've done enough on those trades to really kind of get a rebuild going. Because if you look at what having James Wood in the lineup, having Mackenzie Gore in the rotation, you know, Josiah Gray, when he comes back from his arm injury, guys like that, CJ Abrams, who made the All-Star team this year, you got to have guys do things like that. You got to have players who you acquired really take those steps forward. You're not going to hit on all of them, you know, and that's fine. But they hit on enough of them to really provide a pretty massive youth boost, you know, boost of young talent to a system that really needed it. And now the question is okay, now can you take it further? Because we just talked about this is a division where it's going to be really hard because the Braves aren't going anywhere, the Phillies aren't going anywhere, and the Mets have more money to spend than anybody. But I do feel like it's a little bit more optimistic now. Anything, any last parting thoughts, Jeff, as we kind of wrap up here on the NL East?
No, I think this is an exciting division at the major league level. And I think you look at a few of these systems and you can see how it can get even more competitive over the next couple of years if some of these talented players come to fruition at the major league level.
But well, so that's our way wrap up of the NL East. We're going to keep these going. You know, tomorrow we will have the NL Central state of the organizations, and then the following day we will have the NL West state of the organizations. So if you're enjoying this, please like and subscribe on podcast or on YouTube. Feel free to leave a comment on YouTube, and we try to read those and respond to them as we can. And for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League, and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. oracle.com/bandwidth.